Hey folks, Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman here. Thank you for being members of the Cafe Insider community.
This is Backstage, a special segment of the Now and Then podcast exclusively for you. We hope you enjoy it.
We wanted to talk about the play Hamilton because the changing response to that over time is right in with this other idea that we've been talking about shifting narratives and how you can see them shifting and how you can see people responding to them.
Well, I'm actually really interested that you said that the left has not really been responding because Hamilton.
But the interesting thing about that, so I'm going to say stuff about Hamilton here, and some of it's going to be no longer true. Culture isn't static, so that's one reason why. When Hamilton came out, there was a crazy, wild, positive response. Some of that was from the right because they were really excited that people had, there was a play about Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison, and it was, you know, the elite founding dead white guys, and that was a great thing. And then other people were excited because either the cast was entirely people of color or the story being told was, you know, this founder raised himself up by his bootstraps and he was an immigrant, and there was that story being told. And both of those things for a time were happening at the same time, which is really interesting. So I think that part of the play's powerful sort of burst of popularity, and this is a small part because there are so many reasons why that play took off, but one of them has to do with it for a time. It appealed to a lot of different narratives, a lot of different stories, and a lot of different people could own what it was saying in a way that felt different, really different from what they'd seen before.
Well, and that's really the beauty of a cultural narrative is that everybody can have access to it. It is not exclusionary or it's not intended to be exclusionary. But I will point out here that one of the reasons Hamilton takes off is it's freaking brilliant.
Yes. You know, that, so we're allowed to say that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a neophyte about a lot of this stuff. But man, the minute that my nephew put that tape on for me, I almost drove off the road. I was like, oh my gosh, this is a big deal.
I have to tell a story about my brother who, it's brilliant theater. It's brilliant theater. I suppose you could link it a little bit to A Chorus Line, but it's brilliant and different. And the story I wanted to tell based on you almost driving off the road is I took my brother to see it very early in its Broadway run. And so he's sitting next to me and it starts and he's kind of sitting there. My brother is a very low-key guy. You know, he has sort of a wry sense of humor. And about 5-10 minutes into the play, he starts hitting me, and I turn to him, and he says, "What is this? What is this? This is amazing." So the fact that he had that response, I was like, "Okay, wow. Well, it got him," and it really has to do with the play itself, not necessarily with the history that it's telling, although that's a big part of it, but with how it's being told.
Well, and it's a story of real people, right, which is incredibly powerful. I would like to point out here that we are not the only ones who thought it was brilliant. It had 16 Tony Award nominations. It won 11 Tonys. And as of mid-2019, it had gross ticket sales of over $475 million, $4 million in ticket sales in a single week in December 2018, and more than 2.6 million people have seen Hamilton on Broadway. Another 8 million more have seen it on Disney Plus. I mean, this is an absolute cultural phenomenon. But the historians were not all that happy with this.
Well, exactly. And because of what you were just saying, Heather, because it was so popular and it had such a massive impact, I think if it hadn't, historians wouldn't have cared so much. But there were a lot of historians who responded to it because it was this juggernaut. It was everywhere and everyone was seeing it. And suddenly everyone wanted to learn about the founding period and everyone needed to know who Hamilton was. There were a good number of historians who thought, really? Like it has a cast of color, but it's still the same 8 elite white guys. So this is a play that just sort of sucks us back into an old version of history, doesn't really talk about slavery, doesn't talk about really what was really going on in that time period is kind of this heroic narrative. And it mattered a lot to some historians because of the power of the play and because of the power of the narrative it created. So, you know, it's a sign of how powerful that cultural kind of a story can be. The sign was the power of the response, the real intense, let's call it grouchiness, of some historians.
Do you remember what you said to me when I said that? No. You said, but it's not history.
Right.
It's musical theater.
Right. No, it is musical theater. You know, it's musical theater that has a lot of history in it. Enough history in it that people can point at it and say it's history. So it wasn't nonfiction. It's fiction. It's musical theater. You know, the dead white guys were not dancing around and singing.
But what I took out of it was that the principles of the founding of the country were accessible to everybody. I knew it wasn't historical, but I thought it was just a brilliant reworking of the American principles for the modern era.
Precisely. So that was what I got from it. Speaking as an early Americanist, it's not as though people were normally hyper-attracted to early American history. I mean, you know, lots of people took my courses, and that's nice. But the play, because it was so accessible and it made the founding, however you want to define it, something that was human and real, grabbed at people in a way that I had never seen before in the realm of early American history and made people want to learn more. To me, that was a real strength, right? Because then we as historians can step into that hole and say, okay, well, here's what it says happened. Let's talk about what really happened. I think that's a positive thing. But that remains something that is up for debate among historians. The reason why I think Heather and I first lit on this as something to talk about has to do with something that's very recent. So the play comes out, has a huge raving response. Then there's a response partly by historians, partly by others about the fact that basically slavery isn't there. It still is a dead white guy elite narrative. And that's really problematic in a story that's that broad, despite the fact that now it's accessible. Now, what I have been seeing recently is people, and I suppose now it partly has to do with the movie version of it and partly has to do with Lin-Manuel Miranda, now people are attacking him for doing movies, I suppose, In the Heights is part of this narrative here, part of this debate, for making movies that are not true to people of color in some way. They're attacking him really aggressively. I saw this on Twitter, and it stunned me because it's the opposite end of the spectrum from the mass cheering when it came out. Now people are saying, you're not telling the full story. And it's partly the same response. This is so powerful and so important. So many people get it. If you're not telling our story, and they were saying the same thing about the movie In the Heights that just came out, if you're not telling our story, it matters a lot. You can see if you're looking for cultural change, just track how people responded to Hamilton. It shows you so much about where Americans are and what they're looking for and what they feel they need.
So we are now then in the middle of another cultural change, but which direction it's going to go is, it seems, up in the air. So thanks, Joanne. That was cool. And people had some questions. So
Excellent. Let's
go ahead and hit the questions. And Beverly would like to know, do most major cultural changes have to hinge on some great atrocity? Matt Turner, John Brown, Emmett Till, or George Floyd, or some invention? And that's really important. We didn't talk a lot about the difference of inventions like the cotton gin and so on. What do you think?
Well, I think that the short answer, do they always have to hinge on some great atrocity? The short answer is no. There can be many things that change things. But I do think those kinds of great, intense atrocities have that kind of power because of the very things, Heather, that you and I have been talking about, which is they grab you at a level, a sort of subconscious level, that it's hard to let go of and that pulls you right in on a human level. So that's partly a reason why some of those kinds of moments can have such a power, because they're powerful as issues of humanity in a way that it's hard to resist. But there are other ways, certainly, in which things can be represented, moment in time, a change in time, that aren't necessarily atrocities and have more to do with culture. I don't know if you have one right at hand.
Yeah, you know, for me, I think I look at it a little bit differently. I feel like in society, there's always some people who aren't happy with the way things are going by definition, right? You've always got a whole bunch of people out there who just aren't happy with the way things are. But for most people, they're like floating along and it's going fine and they're not paying a lot of attention. And then if things aren't going well, maybe more and more of them don't like the way things are going and they start to talk to each other and, you know, but still they're kind of that rumbling. There's a lot of unrest out there, but nobody's actually nothing has made it coalesce. So it's all out there. These things aren't constructed out of air. Then something big happens. A tape of a man being murdered by a police officer. You know, a terrible storm that destroys Galveston, that destroys the government there. You know, there's something big that all of a sudden people can coalesce around and go, I told you I cared about this, and this is why I care about it. And it gives us a language that we didn't have before, because we can always use that as a touchstone. And I would say that about Mr. Floyd's murder, really. Those sentiments were absolutely there, but there hadn't, nothing had quite coalesced yet.
Absolutely, but we're basically agreeing, which is that event coalesced people, but part of what made them coalesce was the intensity of it and the emotion of it and the horror of it, right? It was a horrible moment, and it grabbed at you in a way that it was very hard to resist. And you're right, enabled people to come together and express a sense of frustration and outrage about things that were going on at the time that were summed up by that moment.
It's kind of funny sometimes when you look back in history and you think, why didn't people care about X? And it just wasn't the right moment for it. And that same story presented in a different time would have become a blockbuster. And I think that, I'm thinking of an example that I don't have time to give you now, but, you know, stories that just were at the wrong place at the wrong time, but they were still out there. Here's another one. Sarah said, do you, Joanne, I'm kidding, she actually said it, either of us, have a personal cultural experience which changed how you looked at your country and your own role in this world?
Wow. I guess that's an interesting question that I haven't thought about before. I think I would say two things happening at the same time for me did that. And that was the, for one thing, and Heather and I, we've talked about this before, is the bicentennial, right? So I was like 13, 14 in the lead up and happening of the bicentennial. It had a huge impact on me. I suddenly felt differently about history. I suddenly understood that our history was human, that it was real, that there were real people. It changed how I understood fundamentally history and the United States. At the same time that was happening, there was a busload of anti-Semitism at the school that I was at. An enormous amount of anti-Semitism. Kids making fun of me, you know, using all kinds of words as, you know, slurs that had to do with Judaism. I remember wearing, I started wearing this big Jewish star because I thought, well, you're going to make fun of me for it? Yeah. So like, come for me.
Bring it on.
Bring it on. But so what was happening at the same moment for me was, on the one hand, I was feeling a kind of American we with such a power that it did change the track of my life. It got me interested in history. At the same time, I had people telling me, you're not part of that we. You're not part of it. And the fact that they were both happening at the same time, I think, I hadn't ever thought about it this way, but probably continues to shape how I think about the United States to the present day, which is I have intense feelings about it, the story of it, the humanity of it. And I don't mean humanity as in happy, fluffy, good things, but the humanness of it, the fact that it's a human story matters enormously to me. And the fact that it is not all inclusive and that my experience is one example of how that's true is also part of that story. And those are two things that are powerful and that kind of bang up against each other. But what about you, Heather?
Easy one for me. It was being put on the first incarnation of the Professor Watch list.
So I had done plenty.
It was a big deal. I'd done a lot of, you know, I'd do what I do. I'd taught, I'd written articles for a bunch of people. I'd written for children's magazines and all that. And I'd certainly had a lot of experience with negative commentary on what I do. But when the man started Turning Points USA, it was totally a grifter kind of thing. He just figured out how to pick up a bunch of names. And I know where my name came from, but he literally just sort of cherry-picked them and threw them on a very hastily made website and called us out as dangerous professors who were, I don't know, indoctrinating the youth or whatever, which I took as a real personal affront because, you know, you and I have talked about how we teach in the classroom, but what really shocked me was how national that went, how quickly, and how all of a sudden I couldn't just be a historian any longer. That I had become, I wrote an answer to my friends on my Facebook page in which I talked about why I would not shut up, why America, something to the effect of why America is still worth fighting for. This was immediately after Donald Trump was elected. And then the fat was kind of in the fire. I had no choice but to go ahead and continue doing what I'm doing. So my role in the world changed really dramatically on that day. I can remember the exact minute that it changed when I went, I don't have a choice anymore. You know, I could have walked away before, but I can't any longer. And so, you know, it's ironically, they created me.
And, you know, it's time for us to wind down, but I want to do that by building off of what we just said, which is part of the reason we're doing what we're doing here as a podcast is because we both feel called to shape the narrative, right? To call to step forward and say what we think at a time when it matters, that people know what we think as historians and as educators in addition to as Americans. So the very thing that you felt called upon you to comment because you were being put in a category you didn't want to be, that's the sort of thing that has called both of us forward, that brought us together partly in the first place, and is part of why we come here to you every week on Now and Then.
Thank you for joining us backstage.
Be sure to write to us with your thoughts and questions at letters@cafe.com. See you next time.